The second lecture in this series deals with radiation targets, in particular DNA and chromosomes. In essence, the DNA repair mechanisms that we have are extremely efficient, and one of the reasons for this is that they're continually monitoring chromosomes to correct damage to nucleotides. The endogenous mutagens that exist come from reactive oxygen species primarily as a result of cellular respiration, also from a variety of cellular metabolites that connect to damaged DNA. In addition, there are a number of exogenous mutagens to which we're exposed, which are very large, diverse groups. The most common form of naturally occurring DNA damage is the formation of an apyrimic apyrimidinic site, and there are tens of thousands of these which are produced every day in every cell under physiologic conditions. These are repaired for the most part with an extreme level of efficiency. The number of double-strand breaks per cell per day produced is actually not very well known, but it's estimated that in tissue culture at least 5-10% of dividing mammalian cells have at least one chromosome break or one chromosome gap, and approximately 50 double-strand breaks can be produced for every cell cycle. The reason for this, of course, is in part because the DNA has to be broken for it to be replicated. What is clear is that the failure to repair DNA damage results in a failure of replication, to cell death, or to genomic instability. So the consequences of failure in these mechanisms are severe. Whenever we talk about DNA, it's important to realize just how complex this structure is. I won't go into this now, but some of the important issues really are that often you have to unwind the DNA in order to be able to measure strand breaks. The assays that are available are multiple. I'm not going to concentrate on all of them, but the most popular and classic DNA damage are the neutral or alkaline elution technique, the COMET assay, or the gamma H2AX focus formation assay. The neutral alkaline elution assays are typically carried out by labeling cells with tritiated thymidine. Then you lyse the cells and you put them onto a sucrose density gradient and you elute them. If the DNA is damaged, as it will be following gamma radiation exposure, then there is an increase in the amount of small bits of DNA which are found on the gradient. This assay comes in two forms. Under alkaline conditions, the DNA unwinds, and therefore this measures single-strand breaks and double-strand breaks. Whereas under neutral conditions, it measures only double-strand breaks. Under neutral conditions, it's not very sensitive, unfortunately, and you often need in the order of 5-10 gray to actually see any radiation-induced damage. It's also possible to put the DNA through a filter rather than through a sucrose gradient, but essentially it's a very, very similar kind of technique. What one is looking at is fragments of DNA. The COMET assay is a useful assay, in part because it can be automated, it can be performed on single cells, and again this can be performed under neutral or alkaline conditions for double strand breaks and single strand breaks. Essentially what happens is that cells are placed in agarose, they are lysed, and they are run in electrophoresis, and the small pieces of DNA will form the tail of what looks like a comet as it migrates out under the influence of the electric charge. Again, one of the limitations of this technique is that for double strand breaks, it's not particularly sensitive. The Gamma H2EX focus formation assay is the most modern of the classical assays, if you like. It relies upon the fact that H2EX, the histone, is phosphorylated at the site of double strand breaks. If you use an antibody to the phosphorylated form of H2EX, then you can light up the double strand break. And you see this as a kind of small focus formation. The number of these approximates the number of double strand breaks in the cell. DNA repair proteins are also recruited to the same foci. So the gamma H2EX focus really forms within a minute. They are at a maximum about 10 minutes after radiation, and you get dephosphorylation of the sites of the proteins starting after about 30 minutes. And so by 24 hours, most of the damage has been repaired. I'm not going to talk about the DNA unwinding technique or the pulse field gel technique or the PCR-based techniques. But the micronucleus assay is an interesting assay. It's got a long history. Basically, it's based on the formation of small membrane-bound DNA fragments which look like micronuclei in a cell. Typically, the cells are cultured to arrest them in metaphase using cytochalasin B, and then they are stained for DNA, and it's possible to count the number of cells within micronucleus in them and use this to assess DNA damage. This relates in part to the next topic of conversation, which is the formation of chromosome or chromatid aberrations following radiation. Again, this normally is performed at the first metaphase after radiation, and the type of damage, of course, is going to depend upon where in the cell cycle the cell was irradiated, with chromosome aberrations showing if it's irradiated in a G1 phase and chromatid in S or G2. There are basically two types of lesions which are formed following radiation. There's deletion-type lesions and exchange-type lesions. Deletion-type lesions can be stable or unstable. Often the fragments are lost at mitosis, and this is really how micronuclei form. The exchange-type lesions are of two types. They can either be symmetrical or asymmetrical. The symmetrical ones are generally stable, and they include translocations and inversions of chromosomes, whereas the asymmetrical are generally lethal, and this is due to the formation of dicentrics or rings. Whenever the cell tries to divide, these structures are obviously unstable and will prevent the reassortment of the chromosomes at mitosis. The next two slides shows how chromosome and chromatid aberrations can take place, and it's fairly easy to work through the various structures that can be formed as a result of radiation damage. The way one analyzes chromosomes following radiation exposure has changed considerably over the years. Normally, in the first instance, it was simply a matter of looking at metaphase arrests. With time, it became a little bit more sophisticated as various dyes were used to show up the banding patterns on chromosomes. But now we look at them using FISH or fluorescence in situ hybridization. FISH is essentially a method by which you can paint using fluorescent probes various areas of the chromosome. These are nucleic acid probes that are used, and so in one of these slides you can see there's an example of a chromosome 19 painting probe where there are two chromosomes on the right hand side which are normal. There also is another portion of a chromosome 19 attached to another chromosome which is obviously abnormal. This is can be extended to multicolor fish using multiple probes. So multiplex fish really can show the enormous diversity of damage which can be caused following radiation. And spectral karyotyping, or SCI, can be used to visualize all 23 pairs of the human chromosome at one time. This is a very, very potent, though relatively expensive, technique to use. The yield of radiation-induced chromosome damage obviously depends in part upon what time in the cell cycle radiation took place. A chromatid or a deletion type of lesion can result from a single hit with radiation and will give a linear relationship with dose. These deletions will be lost at mitosis. Whereas an exchange type rearrangement between chromosomes can take place, and if this is going to occur, then certainly for things like translocations in particular, rather than inversion, you would require two hits, and it will then follow a linear quadratic formulation. DNA repair, as I've already said, is an extremely important part of radiation therapy, and classically there are two types of DNA repair which were identified operationally in the early days of radiobiology. There's potentially lethal damage repair and sublethal damage repair, and these are purely operational definitions. The potentially lethal damage repair is considered to occur following a single dose of radiation, whereas the sublethal damage repair is associated with fractionated doses of radiation. The molecular mechanisms underlying these are really not clearly distinguishable. They may be the same in some cases, they may be different. Potentially lethal damage is defined as damage that could cause death, but is modified by the post-irradiation conditions. And the way this was initially discovered was to take some fairly normal cells which form a monolayer and contact-inhibited monolayer of cells on the surface of a petri dish. If you trypsinize these and then plate them out, then one can get a colony count based upon the surviving fraction. If they're irradiated and then trypsinized immediately, then the colony count is relatively low in comparison with cells which are irradiated and then trypsinized, for example, 30 minutes or an hour later. And so during the time where these cells are contact inhibited, there must be some form of repair going on, which is referred to as potentially lethal damage repair. This contrasts with sublethal damage repair, which is considered to be the result of interactions between sites. So if you look at two different doses of radiation, as we did in the last lecture, and separate them by a period of time, then the repair that occurs between the different doses of radiation is considered to be sublethal damage repair. The molecular forms of DNA repair that exist are multiple, perhaps in keeping with the fact that this is such an important biological process. Base excision repair is very important in repairing most spontaneous damage. It's important for the repair of single-strand breaks and base damage after ionizing radiation. Persistence leads to a block in DNA replication, mutations, genomic instability. The process involves an apyrimidinic endonuclease, which removes a few nucleotides before the lesion is ligated. Nucleotide excision repair is a somewhat different mechanism. This is for repairing UV photo damage. It's responsible for removing chemical adducts and crosslinks. It really is of fairly minor importance for ionizing radiation, though some of the molecules that are involved in nucleotide excision repair are used to repair radiation damage as well. DNA mismatch repair corrects base space mismatches and small loops in DNA, in particular those which form during replication. Again, not of great importance for ionizing radiation, but is of particular importance in hereditary colorectal cancer, where some of the genes which are associated with this disease are involved in DNA mismatch repair. From a radiation perspective, obviously double-strand break repair is perhaps the most important type of repair to be considered. There are other types of repair that exist. Obviously there's chemical repair rather than biological repair. And there are enzymes that reverse DNA damage. One of these is MGMT, which removes methyl and other alkyl groups from DNA. And this is thought to be particularly important in the response of GBM tumors to temozolomide, where those who have a methylated MGMT promoter seem to respond better. The use of repair molecules and the processes of DNA really depend upon a very large number of factors, and it's a very complex set of mechanisms. Overall, we think there are maybe 130 to 150 DNA repair genes. The easiest way to think of DNA repair is really involving three basic processes. First of all, nucleases come along to remove the damaged DNA. Then polymerases are involved in laying down the basic structure, and ligases in the restoration of the phosphodiester backbone. You can see this happening in basic scission repair, nucleotide excision repair, and mismatch repair. So in basic scission repair, as a kind of classic example, is that glycosylases recognize and remove damaged bases, and then the nuclease comes along which cleaves the backbone and essentially removes the damaged area. In this case, only a few nucleotides are actually removed. The DNA polymerase comes along to fill up the gap, and the DNA ligase is involved in formation of the backbone. Double-strand breaks are a much more complex kind of mechanism of repair. These can be formed physiologically or pathologically. It's important to realize that from a physiological point of view, there are examples of double-strand break repair. So in order to make antibodies or T-cell receptors, one needs a process known as VDJ recombination of the genes which are involved in these structures. In order to recombine these genes, the DNA has to be broken and it has to be reformed. There are other examples of double-strand break physiological mechanisms, for example, in the antibody isotype class switching. Or during meiosis, double-strand break formation and repair is involved. Obviously, this mechanism is subsumed in pathological processes, for example, following ionizing radiation exposure, or during exposure to reactive oxygen species, or other types of DNA damage which can result in double-strand break formation. There are essentially two models of double-strand break repair. The first is homologous recombination. And in homologous recombination, a sister chromatid or a second chromosome is used as a template for the repair process. This means that the process is relatively error-free, It's certainly is a process which is used under normal physiological conditions. And mutants that are defective in homologous recombination do have a large increase in chromosome aberrations, but generally there is some repair of double-strand breaks that goes on. The major players in this form of homologous recombination are RAD51, RAD52, XRCC2, RAD54, and BRCA1 and 2, the BRCA breast cancer related tumor suppressor genes. The second model of double-strand break repair is non-homologous end joining. And this is really a very different type of mechanism from homologous recombination. Essentially, it uses a non-homologous template which has little or no microhomology regions in it. What this means is that it's a very imprecise mechanism, makes many mistakes. This is actually an advantage if you're involved in the immune system. Importantly, this mechanism is active at any time during the cell cycle, so it is much more adaptable than homologous recombination. Its mechanism is very efficient at restoring chromosomal integrity, and this is one of the major mechanisms for doing this. It's obviously, as far as the cell is concerned, much more important that the integrity of the chromosome is maintained even though there are mistakes made in the DNA sequence. It's the major mechanism of DNA of double-strand break repair. It's used physiologically as in VDJ rejoining of T-cell and immunoglobulin receptors. And mammalian mutants, which are deficient in non-homologous end joining, are therefore deficient in both DNA repair and in the immune system. So this results in a severe combined immune deficiency disease, or SCID disease, in both mice and humans. The major players here are Ku70, Ku80, Artemis, DNA, PK, DNA protein kinase, Serunos, XRCC4, and Ligase4. These two types of mechanism, the non-homologous end joining and homologous recombination, actually share some molecules, and this is known as the MRN complex, the MRE11, RAD50, and MBS1 complex. MRE11 and RAD50 are important for mammalian cell survival. NBS is interesting because it's the Nijmegen breakage syndrome protein is coded for by this gene. It's known as Nibrin. And Nijmegen breakage syndrome patients are sensitive to radiation. They've got microcephaly. They've got immune deficiencies, predisposition to lymphoid malignancies, and cells show similarities to ataxia telangiectasia. There's a defect in double-strand break repair, there's radio-resistant DNA synthesis, they don't undergo cell cycle arrest following radiation, or at least the cell cycle arrest that they undergo is abnormal. As far as the mechanism of repair is concerned, most is known about non-homologous end joining. What happens is that Ku70, Ku80 heterocomplex binds to DNA, and this initiates the binding of other components, in particular nucleases that remove the DNA, polymerases, which are involved in laying down the nucleotide structure, and the ligases that restore the phosphodiester backbone. The nucleases that are involved in this process are formed from Artemis and DNA PKCS. This process of binding actually activates DNA PK, which is a protein kinase, And this kinase also phosphorylates, and it's that which aids the binding of other repair processes. The Pol X family members are the major polymerases that are involved, whereas the ligases are Cyrunonos, DNA4 ligase, XRCC4 DNA4 ligase complex. As already said, this process is very much involved in VDJ rejoining, which is the mechanism by whereby one chain or one part of one chain of an antibody molecule is brought together with another part so that each lymphocyte can make one immunoglobulin or one T-cell receptor, as the case may be. So the non-homologous end-joining apparatus is interesting because not only do you end up with DNA repair taking place as a result of the formation of the DNA PK CS Ku70 Ku80 Artemis interaction, but you activate this DNA PK. And this DNA PK then goes on to phosphorylate a whole range of different proteins, including H2AX, which we talked about earlier in terms of double strand break repair. So DNA PK is the only protein known to be activated by binding to double strand breaks. It's a very important molecule in terms of double strand break repair. It's actually formed from the DNA PKCS, which is the catalytic subunit, or the inactive form, which becomes activated by binding to Ku70, Ku80. It's a serine threonine kinase with homology to a PI3 kinase, but it's got no lipid activity. And SCID mice are defective in DNA PKCS. This is not true for most SCID humans, which seem to be more defective in Artemis. The importance of this process of DNA repair by non-homologous end-joining can be seen whenever you look at DNA PKCS negative cells. 2 hours after radiation with one gray, you get a very large increase in the number of foci that are formed in a gamma H2AX assay. And even 24 hours after radiation, this persists. So you can see just how important this is in terms of genomic instability. Homologous recombination has several complex mechanisms involved, but essentially they're relatively similar in many respects to non-homologous end-joining, though the molecules are different. And the important difference really is that they use chromosomes and chromatids as templates for the repair process. So this involves a straight strand exchange mechanism with a resolution of what is known as the holiday junction, which is formed. These strand gaps are then filled in, and the system is effectively repaired. So whenever one looks at non-homologous end-joining, homologous recombination, and also the mRN complex, which is involved in both of these processes, one can see that downstream of these repair mechanisms, we have kinases. For the non-homologous end-joining, there's DNA PK. For mRN, there is ATM, the ataxia-telangiectasia mutated protein, and downstream of homologous recombination mechanisms, there's activation of BRCA1, which is the breast cancer, hereditary breast cancer gene. And one thinks, therefore, that these initiate a whole process of signal transduction, which leads to cell cycle arrest, apoptosis, and of course is involved in DNA repair itself. So there are cellular consequences of double strand break repair following radiation, which are really quite important. To put this into another framework, You can see how DNA, PK, CS, ATN, and kind of a molecule which is very similar to ATM, which is involved more in UV damage and the interaction with cross-linking agents. All of these kinases feed into downstream pathways. So DNA PK will phosphorylate H2AX and will lead to focus formation. ATM will phosphorylate P53, and P53 has downstream of it BEX, which is responsible for apoptosis induction, P21, which is responsible for G1S arrest, and it will also even phosphorylate MDM2 or interact with MDM2 as a result of its phosphorylation, and this will remove P53, leading to its degradation. Downstream of ATM and ATR, there are the molecules SHIC1 and SHIC2, which phosphorylate CDC25, which results in G2 arrest and S phase delay. So it's very easy to see how there is a very strong link between double-strand break repair and all of the hallmark cellular responses, from cell cycle arrest to cell death, downstream of these pathways. So the DNA repair genes are themselves thought of as being genomic caretaker genes, and they prevent cancer by removing DNA mutations. And this may be particularly true of the homologous recombination genes, which are involved, or whose proteins are involved during S phase, G2 phase. Defects in DNA repair cancer genes are very common in cancer, and loss of many DNA repair genes is embryonic lethal. Those who, for whom it's not embryonic lethal will often result in a high incidence of cancers. The clinical significance of this is obvious in terms of individuals who have ataxia telangiectasia, for example, where they're extremely sensitive to radiation. On the other hand, there are a lot of individuals who are carriers of defective DNA repair genes, and their role in determining the outcome of radiation exposure is not terribly clear. Certainly, there is evidence that they may have an increased risk of cancer. But it's also possible that there are sufficient numbers within the population that they actually set the tolerance limits for radiation doses which are used clinically. So there are a number of autosomal recessive disorders with repair defects, and many of these will result in genomic instability and cancer. Probably the most relevant from a radiation perspective is ataxia telangiectasia, which is a very rare disease. They have a high incidence of cancers, but extreme sensitivity to ionizing radiation. They have a chromosomal instability, DNA repair defect, and a signal transduction defect as well. This means that they have altered cell cycle arrest patterns, in particular no G1S arrest and no S phase delay. ATM was cloned in 1995 and shown to have homology to the PI3 kinase superfamily, to which the DNA PK also belongs. There are, however, a range of different DNA repair defects which are somewhat similar to AT, and there may be a very large subset, in fact, of syndromes which are fairly similar. Nyman breakage syndrome, I've already mentioned, is very similar to AT in many respects, although that protein is involved in the MRN complex. And there is an AT-like disorder, which is due to MRE11 defect. Other important molecules are obviously BRCA1 and BRCA2, in which there is a lot been discovered in recent years. It's important to realize that not all of these syndromes are associated necessarily with sensitivity to ionizing radiation. AT is the classic example, NVS, AT-like disease, all of these are certainly show radiation sensitivity. But the other diseases are very variable in terms of the response to ionizing radiation. And although BRCA1 and 2 are known to be involved in homologous recombination, it's hard to actually see their role in the response to of individuals to radiation therapy, although this may well occur. And the reason for this really is that homologous recombination probably plays a lesser role than non-homologous end joining in terms of double strand break repair. Double strand break repair by non-homologous end joining being able to occur in any phase of the cell cycle.